Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hi, I'm Brendan from Bristol. You're listening to Dane Baptiste Questions Everything. My question is, what's the biggest animal you could take in a fight? Okay, here comes the show. And remember, question everything.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to Dane Baptiste Questions Everything, a podcast with myself, comedian, writer, and occasional actor, Dane Baptiste, and my producer friend, Howard Cohen, a.k.a. The Hizzer.
Hello!
And a mix of very special guests pose the questions that need to be asked. And we're talking everything from...
Well, we're talking everything from Brendan from Bristol's question. What's the biggest animal you could take in a fight? Dane, I'm going to go probably... By taking a fight, I assume he means kill.
If you say so, Howard. He didn't mention kill here.
I'm gonna suggest kind of nothing more than a big dog. That's where I've got to. Dane, what do you reckon?
Well, since you took the levels up to a death match, Howard, I'm probably I'm gonna go with a llama. Because it's a rat, it's quite big. But they don't know that they can do anything, and one lock punch to the neck. This is terrible. This is a terrible great question, but the answer I'm giving is terrible. So I'd have to take a swing at a llama. I feel like...
I couldn't kill a horse. I know I couldn't kill a horse. They'd kill me.
That's it. And also, I would prefer not to kill anything that's endangered, because then it's right. Added bad press. So I think llamas, they seem to be there at petting zoos and stuff. They're relatively docile. And I feel like I can still do cage fighting rules. They can tap out or knock out. I don't have to kill a llama.
Yeah,
I
just don't want it. It's easy to put a llama in a sleeper hold, I imagine.
But there you go. Yeah, I'll do something like that.
Listen, Brendan, I hope that helped you. And look, suffice to say, on this podcast, we ask and answer all the questions, don't we, Dane?
Absolutely. No question is too big, too small, too smart, or too silly. And if you do like the show, please rate and review on Apple Podcasts or follow us on Spotify and you'll never miss an episode. Or subscribe to us on Acast, the world's biggest podcast network, where you can hear all of our special questions being answered by our very special guests. With that being said, on today's show is a British stand-up comedian, actor and radio presenter and writer. He was nominated for Leicester Mercury Comedian of the Year in 2016. He is supported, among others, his very talented mother, Angela Moore, and the king of comedy, Dave Chappelle, as well as Kojo and him on tour. His Edinburgh debut show, Funny Petty Cool, received critical acclaim, and he is also the creator and co-presenter of the popular weekly boxing podcast, Undefeated, with fellow comedian, KG the Comedian, which is enjoyed by many people, including Eddie Hearn. Please welcome to the show, Mr. Travis J.
Hey, what's going on, guys?
Clearly, Travis, we want to know what's the biggest animal you think you could kill, mate?
So, like,
as a pugilist as well, because
as a
pugilist, you're trained. So,
I'll take a kangaroo. I'll take a medium-sized kangaroo.
So I'm saying that's a real purist, you know, because you could take an easy animal, but see, you obviously want to work out because they'd be boxing.
That's what I'm saying. Like, put some gloves on him, and we could just go rules of Queensbury and just go for it, man.
I like that. Can they use tails? Is he allowed to use the tails and the feet?
I think we might have to nail that down, because tail whip might be insane. I can see it working out.
Yeah, just want to make clear to all the listeners who are animal lovers, we are not actively looking to do this.
No animals will be harmed in this hypothetical scenario. However, listeners, I want to let you know that the way that mainstream media is declining every day in morality, we're not too far off interspecies fighting.
Yeah, comedians versus animals. I can already see the TV pitch.
Also, you know, I think I saw on the internet that they mixed a human embryo with a pig one. I saw that somewhere.
Is there pictures?
It might be online. You can find it's like a human pig hybrid embryo. And I'm saying that could be bred for fights. It's not Earth. It happens in space. If you go to a virgin boxing match hosted by Richard Branson, Travis.
Elon Musk, fam. Elon Musk is going to be the promoter.
Elon Musk will definitely be the sponsor for
Tesla promotions.
Tesla promotions for interspecies and war. Yeah, I mean, the future is so bleak in that respect.
It's really disgusting.
It's all over. Welcome to the end of the world.
Can I just say, there is a show that I saw in America where the people had to do a tug of war against a fully grown bear and then try and beat it in an eating contest of having raw salmon and blueberries. Wow. And they lost every single time. As we all expected.
It's like, why bother?
Why bother?
If a bear was coming at you, they say, like, stand still, right? Is that like,
I think it may vary between bears because it's either they're fine of you if you're maybe you're supposed to be that like, big as well. Mm. There's another bear if you play dead. I think the best way to deal with the bear attacks is the way human beings are dealing with it. Ecological devastation. It's just mashing up the habitats, mashing them up all the time.
Yeah. You can
so by the time they get to you, they are so malnourished. Yeah,
so malnourished. There's no power at all. No,
yeah.
Just batter them.
Gumming up your arm from the anemia. Just gumming it up from the lack of iron they are finding in available vegetables.
Big useless
animal. Come here, you never see any
lean bears, do you? It'd be good.
Well, it depends where you are. So there's certain parts of Antarctica now where they're a bit skinnier.
Shave them. Just shave them. I reckon they are chiseled underneath them.
I think they are really chiseled. Bears are real strong.
They're like 7'2", just walking around.
I'm sure they haven't got... When they get in the hind legs, it gets crazy, man. Like, even a bear scratch.
I'm sure there's no peck. There's no definition on those muscles. No, it's no,
not like kangaroos. Now, they're toned.
Yeah,
kangaroos and gorillas, they're winning all the bodybuilding contests.
Sorry, you're telling me if we shave a kangaroo, you'd put a picture of him up on the fucking wall? Have you not seen
the picture of that lean, like, really a very strong kangaroo?
Lean kangaroo.
We will have to share this another time.
But then there's also that turtle that restarted his species because he had sex with like 43 other turtles women. And he restarted his entire species. So you have to choose what kind of strength you want as an alpha in this world.
That's a legendary story to carry down the journey. Yeah,
absolutely. You know, he walks into a bar every single time and he's just like, oh no, deja vu.
You're all my children.
Exactly.
Well, it's probably time for a question, isn't it, Dane, as the format of this show tends to dictate.
Absolutely. As our very esteemed guest, Travis, we invite you to ask the first question, any question you would like, which we'd like to discuss for 15 minutes and some change. Then Howard has a question for you and I that he'd like to ask and we'd like to discuss. And then finally, I have a question I'd like to pose to you, which I hope is never too probing or offensive, which I'd like to discuss for 15 minutes as well. And once we're done, I'd like the good people listening to the podcast to find out where they can find out about all of your good works, past, present and future. How's that sound, bro?
Sounds great.
All right. Well, the floor is yours to ask our first question.
Okay. So my question is, is free will real or is it just an illusion?
That question is just brilliant. And I have to ask, what inspired it, Travis?
Do you know what? I think about these things, like, I think about random questions, like, for example, nature versus nurture. I just tend to be on that type of wave. Mm-hmm. Do you know what I mean? I think what's pushed me on that type of introspective vibe is growing up with my mum as a stand-up comic, me getting into stand-up comedy. I've always trying to challenge, like, was this like in my blood or is it just because of my environment? So you start to look at things like free will and you start thinking there are definitely other forces at play with how we see the world, how we integrate in society and all these type of things. So it's like, I don't know how to kind of put this into words, but sometimes you do feel like, well, was that an independent thought of mine or was this just like a processed environment I'm just in an echo chamber of?
I mean, I've got so many things to say, as I'm sure Dane has about this.
Go ahead, Howard. Let your will...
I can't help but think about the thing that I think about a lot at the moment, Dane, which is Adam Curtis films. I seem to be bringing up Adam Curtis films a lot. I don't know if you watch them, do you, Travis?
No, I don't.
Really good. He does a lot of documentaries on BBC. Like one of his big documentaries is the Hypernormalization.
Okay.
But it's just he does a really amazing like anthology retrospective of like the media's presence in like socio-political changes and stuff like that, and how it does, and like I said, how it influences will, and if will is a function of suggestion, like you said, just the result.
He's like the Radiohead of documentaries. He's like this kind of philosophical, artistic guy. And Travis, when you happen to watch one of them, I'd like you to text me to tell me. thank you for bringing it to my attention. But the thing about what he talks about is that we are being conditioned. Now, I would look at my 14-month-old child and tell you that this week, and by the way, there's a listener who keeps taking the piss out of me for bringing up my kid, What do you want me to do? He's fucking here every day. He's fucking every here day. Every day. So what do you want me to do? I've got to talk about him. I don't know what you want me to do.
Imagine
how
you feel bad about that.
This brother is always loving his son, bro. It's like it's unconditional. Every day.
This week.
What happened to the cat, bro? Remember, when the cat, remember the cat days, bro? When Howard had no children, bro? He's changing now, bro.
But the guy was sick last week for his first time. He was sick. He got like a throat thing and he's got teething and he got fucked off at that and he was very miserable. And then after he's come out of that week, he's evolved a little bit. It's quite interesting. He had the week of sitting there being miserable and he's come out and now he's like testing his boundaries. And it's kind of very interesting to see that, you know, when I say to him, come here, he looks at me and kind of smiles because he knows that if he doesn't come here, he's pushing. So that is the definition of nature in my thing. He's developing, you know, he's growing. Yeah. And I think that, as in like testing your boundaries, like how often do you feel, you two are comedians, so you're constantly testing your boundaries. But I think most people are just set within very clear boundaries at the moment, Dane. And I don't see much thinking outside the box. They're not allowed to.
True.
Well, I mean, I guess it's a really good question because I guess it's what you define as the will. And what forms that? Because I might be mistaken. I can't think of your will being a part of something that's tangible. But then at the same time, most people, depending on what school or thought you come from, I guess philosophically, your will could be like, you know, your sentience and your consciousness that drives you to, you know, do stuff which may be either guided by your instinct, or I guess you have your psychosexual explanation with Freud, where it's like you have your id, which drives your need for gratification, and then the ego and the super ego, which might drive your need as a social species to be validated. So I say all that to say this, man, with a will, I feel like it's maybe something that's similar to having a conscience. When I speak the conscience from a moral perspective, is that it's how much people are willing to engage it. Mm-hmm. So, for example, I think, you know, whether it's would, and I might be falsely describing instincts, but I guess we all have the will to live, right? Or you're born with the will to live. And then depending on your environment, your experiences, they say nature versus nurture, your survival instinct will be, and I guess your determination to survive will be strengthened based on your experiences. But at the same time, obviously that comes with a lot of personal responsibility. And I feel like we live in a world where as a social species, we've kind of confused that interaction for delegation. And a lot of time, I think people have will, but we, as a society, have created a lot of institutions that alleviate people of having to kind of pay attention to it, if that makes sense.
So
as in like, I hear people, for example, talk about like immigrants filling up hospital beds or filling up hospitals. And I guess that could stem from, you know, a will to live, which itself could be the catalyst for that, could be the fear of not being. But then really, I think, shouldn't your strongest will to be never to need to go to hospital in the first place?
Interesting. Very interesting.
As in like, surely the achievement would be through nutrition or, you know, self-care that you wouldn't need to require a hospital, especially because when you think about it, doctors in many cases have a lower life expectancy than an average person of the same socioeconomic group. Then we give over power to this institution or to people who are supposed to trust us with, we trust to tell us how to maintain our well-being so we can, you know, live longer and help us with our will to live. But by the same token, it's like, surely you would probably observe a healthier lifestyle and not want to be in a position in the first place. So,
you know what I find fascinating, right? So let's look at this free will conversation, because let's say a kid grows up in whatever area, wants to be a football player. Mm-hmm. He, you know, believes this is his passion. I could argue you've watched football, you've seen success. You know, I know growing up, I looked at Ian Wright and I saw, whoa, this is a young black football player. And, you know, you don't often see celebrities like young black celebrities in other kind of other than music. Mm-hmm. So growing up being young black, I wanted to play football. A lot of my friends wanted to rap. This feels like a very doctored echo chamber. Yeah. But then you look at someone, say, for example, very extreme example here, a serial killer from a family of a loving family. He just wants to kill. Do you say that guy has free will?
I mean, yeah, that's a good question. I, do you know what it is? I think it's, again, and not to make it more complicated, it's because of what you considered to be will. Because I guess will for me would be then the energy that is used to drive instinct or to drive, or use as drive for the for your achievements. That's the fuel for your drive. So in those two examples you used, I would say maybe the will is for people to try and transcend their situation or their environment. Mm. And maybe in this case, football was the vehicle by which you achieve that. So using that unique example, because we grew up in the same area, if listeners don't know, Travis and I grew up in Southeast London. Mm-hmm. And so as career paths to observe a certain level of opulence and social mobility, most of the people we would see would be entertainers or athletes. Ian Wright being a great example of that. So I guess most people were like, I want to be able to transcend my situation without losing a part of myself. So when I look at something that seems to represent that the most, I project onto it. So I guess my will is to try and emulate that excess. So people might follow that same path. And I think, so then that's your, that paradigm of achievement. I want to do what Ian Wright did. But I guess what makes that happen is your own will pushing you to kind of satisfy that same thing. Mm. But by the same token, the serial killer example was interesting as well, where it's like, a lot of the time, and some psychologists have the proof of that, is that it's typical of a lot of a lot of serial killers come from families where love and affection and even forming those centers of the brain, which are, you know, generate your release of endorphins or dopamine when you experience like care or nurturing from somebody else, they don't develop that. So they're not able to develop empathy in the first place. Mm-hmm. That's kind of the mind state that might be comes towards forming their will. So, and I'm not saying this affects will. So what I'm saying is, so they have a mindset where, you know, a lot of times victims of trauma tend to try and recreate the same aesthetic but when they're in a position of control. Mm-hmm. So the example of that would be like some people the whole thing with R. Kelly is that like he dressed even some of the young girls as like to make them look a bit more non-binary or look more like some of the women that he was abusing, he made them look more like young boys. And this is based on this idea that he was himself was sexually abused when he was younger. And that sometimes is a common behavior of people who are victims of trauma. It's recreating something that's very similar, but them in being controlled in the same way that they say hurt people, like bullies are normally bullied at home themselves.
Yeah.
But so I think everyone can kind of have that mentality, but it's about your will, whether or not you're going to allow that to push you to do those kind of things. And so the other thing I'm saying is that in the great example you had, Shav, you said about someone coming from a good family and still choosing to kill people, because that's what they say about Jeffrey Dahmer, isn't it?
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, he came from a good household. But I guess what we are quantifying as good may be due to the fact that, as Howard said, the boundaries that he may or should have had from coming from an affluent home, he didn't have them. So, for example, being the fact that he was on the outside, a affluent white man, you know, the fear the fear of consequence for his actions is not going to be the same that you and I would have.
Yeah, of course.
So the aesthetic for him, his will to be able to be kind of carried out, is very different. Mm. It's very different. And
I'd go as far to say there isn't free will, and I'll tell you the reason there isn't free will. Apart from for children who have no knowledge of society, right? We're putting them to one side. The reason we don't have free will is because we have a belief in one very simple thing, and we all have it, and it's called story. Story dominates our narratives as people. We are all consumed by our own story or the stories of those around us. Like Ian Wright, you just brought up. It was a story, yeah. Right? It was this incredible story. Do you remember when Ian Wright was hosting his own fucking Friday night show?
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? What a fucking story. This guy almost didn't play football, right? And suddenly he's on his own show and his own single in the charts on Top of the Pops, right? It is story. We are all obsessed by following the story. And unfortunately, there are only so many paths that story can take. So we'll see a story like this Britney Spears story, right? It feels a little bit different, but we've definitely heard this story before. Like there's some similar exploitation of famous children, ultimately, that's happened many times before. So I feel, in a kind of slightly cynical TV producer way, that all our world is so dominated by story and the same stories that we don't have free will because we're just following the paths of the stories that play out.
But then, Howard, I have a rebuttal for that, because you said stories are a big part of us. Chronicling our humanity is why we kind of
tried to be guided, which we're guided largely by suggestion, especially like from, you know, predecessors or ancestors or just cultural norms and etiquette that is passed down to us. But here's my trump card, yeah, chattel slavery, because that would have taken place under the under the premise that African people don't have souls or will, and they're just guided by instinct, and they're essentially three-fifths of human being and thus beasts of burden. Obviously, life has shown that this is not the case.
Correct.
And I guess if the entirety of your upbringing and life was based on a suggestion that you don't have a humanity, something esoteric must have had to come from these people for them to be aware of their humanity and reclaim it, and obviously challenge the suggestion that they don't have, you know, a mind or a soul. So what would have been the catalyst for that? I think, again, you could argue human beings are social species. I think, you know, people that were chattel slaves could have been taken visual and audio clues from whatever they were seeing, which would have made them aware of their humanity. I mean, there was a lot of techniques that were used. Yeah, go ahead.
You also have the exceptions against the rule, as in, like, you have slaves and this is going on, but then you also have the one or two here and there that are sprinkled out that aren't subjected to that same treatment, and they are, you know, black and around that time. Mm-hmm. And might even have wealth. In small pockets of society. And, you know, these little gems of, you know, experiences spread, and it becomes a story that passes around and probably inspires hope amongst that demographic. Do you see what I mean? Then it's like, now there's a vision of what this could look like, what this life could be like, and it can just spread.
But then that's the thing. Could that be the catalyst for free will if it's not a tangible thing? Because again, it's like, if will is free, I mean, doesn't mean it's not subject to suggestion or manipulation. I think it's just down to like people's understanding of it and their level of introspection and how much they want to put towards it. So I think
great will, question, I must like, say. Like, what a
yeah,
question.
Great question. I think will like a conscience. I think there is such a thing as free will, but it's if people are willing to exercise that freedom.
Yeah.
Nice. I think that's a good.
That's a really good question.
That's healthy.
Really good question. You know what? And I actually like how philosophical that one is, because we often talk about very current issues, right, Dane? But that kind of taps into current stuff, but also
it's timelessness, isn't it? Yeah.
Timeless question from Travis Day, everyone.
Come on.
Being asked since Aristotle and all of that, so. further back to the mystery schools that they went to in Egypt, so you know.
So my question this week is a bit different.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds. And they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Travis, we don't know each other that well, but, you know, I'm just going to kind of pose my question in a particular way. And I think, you know, knowing you as I do, I think you'll accept it, which is, do you want a fucking slap, mate? And I ask you this, because you do a boxing podcast,
that's right,
mate?
Yeah.
So you do a boxing podcast. So that's my way of asking you, What is it like being punched? Because unbelievably, listeners, nobody has ever punched me in the face.
Oh my gosh.
As unbelievable as that is, that I've made it to this ripe old age in my late 30s.
Touch wood.
So wait, is this due to great head movement and or just not fighting?
It is remarkable to think nobody has swung for me, right? It is remarkable.
But I don't know, Howard. I think you have the power to defuse that. I think you're someone who's probably learned, because you've got like loads of older brothers. You can anticipate someone punching you in the face, so you can kind of
you can sense the energy in the room.
You can sense the energy. Not everyone's like that, Howard. Howard, you're not really, you know, as you know, you're not really an ego person, Howard.
No, but I guess the scenario is when if I could think of a couple of examples of times where I've been like, oh shit, I'm about to get into serious trouble here with my words. Let me quickly find a way to use them to get out of this.
And that's why
listeners, that's why listeners, if you ever encounter me in real life and I do something wrong, you will notice how incredibly quickly I say sorry. I am so good at apologizing.
You know how hard it is to punch someone or be like a physical with someone who's apologizing? Oh, you have
You have to hate that person.
Yeah, yeah. As much as one-tenth of the population of this world do seem to quite dislike me, I do believe that I have not been punched in the face. So I wanted to ask if, you know, and obviously you kind of spend quite a lot of time talking about people being punched in the face, Travis. Yeah. Like, have you been punched in the face before?
Yeah, I've boxed before. Like, I've been boxing for like, nine, 10 years. So like, I've been hit in the face a fair few times. And it's a weird feeling. It's a weird thing to describe, because how I talk about it now is like, it's a white light. It literally is just a white light. Do you know what I mean? Mid-sparring, you boom, flash, and you know you're getting hit. The pain tends to arrive later. But that's because you're hyped up, adrenaline's going on. You don't really feel pain in that moment. But if you are like chilling out and someone just hits you, that pain is instant. Like,
one of the sad things is about punch in the face here is that you grow up watching films and it sounds like, like, it's like watching people, it's like listening to people play jazz, like in another room. When you hear the sound of bone licking skin in real life, it sounds more like,
it's disgusting.
Disgusting. It's not nice, man. Not nice.
If you can continue for the rest of your life and not get hit in the face, I'd definitely advise it.
Yeah, I reckon my child will punch me in the face at some point, but not for a while.
Yeah. Well, yeah, that's what Mike Tyson is saying. Mike Tyson said that everyone's got a game plan for they get punched in the face.
There you go.
And I think it's never a truer word spoken.
And also, I'm just thinking, just, you know, just for your safety, it's like, if this is the first time you're being exposed to that type of pain, it's probably not the best time.
Like getting chickenpox in your old age. Gotta do it when you're young, Howard. Go to a party with other kids when they've all got it.
Your skull is not prepared for that today.
And I've got the glasses as well.
Not in these Corona times, Howard.
Do you reckon it's because of my glasses that I've never been punched in the face? I probably haven't said that.
What do you think? Look at Travis.
Yeah,
exactly. Did it help, Travis?
These glasses are probably the reason why I got into some of those scraps.
Oh man, it's
what about you, Dane? You ever been someone ever give you a
bit? I've been punched in the face, but there's also ways you can get punched in the face as well, because you can get, I've been like punched in my cheek and I've been punched like on the side of my face, and I think I've been hit in the forehead. But then there's when someone, when I did karate, for example, that's when I've taken like punches to the face, because the idea is that they're supposed to strike you without drawing blood.
Yeah.
Whereas when you get hit with like a hook or like to your face, which I've also had, it's a very different type of punch. Because like I said, there's that punch, but there's also that, which is like your nose.
Yeah.
And that's also, when someone hits that sinus cavity, oh man.
Thing is, what you want to avoid, right? Like say, when I first got into boxing, one thing they don't ever tell you about is when you get hit in the nose and your eyes, it's like, or you get hit in the eye and your eyes water.
Yeah.
For those few seconds, you are blind in that
yeah,
eye.
Yeah, basically like, you're blind. Yeah, yeah.
Thing.
Yeah, but they hit your nose as well. You're blind for temporarily. It's the worst.
But just my advice, Howard, should a situation get, you know, out of control and you think, okay, now is going to be my day, don't let anyone hit you on the chin, especially the side corners. Chin.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. That's the spot.
Really?
Like, you are out. Yeah.
Have you had that, Travis? Have you had that?
I have had that, but I wasn't out. I went down. I went down. It's like that momentarily, the lights go off in the building.
You'll stumble. I that's when I someone tapped my jaw when I was at university. And luckily, because he was not that experienced in punching, what happens with most people is that they misjudge the swing. So he grazed my chin rather than hitting it. But I still stumbled back because what happens is, if it's your chin, Howard, what happens is that your brain shakes in your skull.
That's right.
So to protect you, it's like, no. Nope.
Yeah, that's it.
It shuts down. Yeah, it shuts it down. So he just goes, nope.
I think I saw somebody, like a trauma expert, explain it. I don't even know if they were true or if this was like a spoof video, but they basically said when you get hit on the corner of your jaw like that and it spins, sometimes your brain stays forward just for that moment, and that disconnect, whilst it gets back, it's like,
curtain, yeah, that's, you know, that's why you get a lot of boxers are still standing up with it. No, I'm fine. And the referee's like, yep, you're not fine.
their legs are moving.
Yeah, their legs are moving. I remember watching K1 as well. There's a fighter called Kung Lee who's like, he used to kind of do the pre-mixed martial arts.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember he did what's called reaping, which is when you sweep someone, but you're throwing them down at the same time.
Yeah.
The guy gets up, yeah, and the referee looks at him and goes, yeah, now you're done. He's like, what do you mean I'm done? What's going on here? I'm still ready. It turned around. There's a dent in his temple. I was like, you are done. you're finished. The referee was like, you are done out here, bro. Like,
when the adrenaline cools off, that's going to kill, bro. Oh, man.
You know, the worst thing is when you get bruised or if someone stings you as well, is that it's like, so you swell. So that's supposed to stop the infection and stuff. And
yeah,
that's the histamine. So people that don't know, that's why you swell up. And then once the swelling starts to go down.
Disgusting.
It's getting real pain. Disgusting. And you know, you see someone punching their eye as well. If they get got good in the eye, I saw a kid get punched in the face when I was at karate and he got good like there. Almost as if the orbit of his skull caught the fist.
Oh.
You know the one when it's like purple up above and below the eye, yeah, and then when that clears up, the eye is still bloodshot for like a month afterwards.
It's disgusting, yeah,
it's
yeah,
disgusting,
yeah,
man. Oh.
I remember when I invited my brother to come and watch me spar, right? Because I was dominating guys. Like the two sessions before that, I was getting busy. So I was like, you know what? Let me bring my little brother to come see this. So in there with sparring, I'm sparring this dude who I'm way better than. So I'm flexing, I'm flicking a jab, I'm mimicking all my favorite fighters. I'm enjoying myself. The next dude, I didn't think I was going to spar again after that. And then my trainer's like, you know what? Let's switch this guy out for this guy. This guy gets in there. Now he's hyped up because he's just been watching me just have my way. I'm still in like laid back mode, like trying to flash and show off for my brother. This dude hit me with the overhand right on the button. Now, the thing is, when you're taking a shot, you don't ever want to lean back. Because once you lean back and you take the shot, there's nowhere for you to go. You just absorb all of the shot, bruv. I leaned back, I ate that shot, I fell down. And the maddest thing is, the way I fell down and my legs came up. On my back, legs go up, and then my legs slammed back down. It was...
Man. But face first?
No, on my back.
Oh, my back. Oh, and the legs went... Oh, yeah.
Legs went up.
Crazy, bro. It's all right, man. Trying to get that blood back to your head, boy.
when you hit someone, though, because I've never really hit anyone, really. Yeah. I think I hit John Fells in the middle of a football match in PE because he was just ruining the game. And I hit him on the back of the head.
So you could have... So that's manslaughter, Howard. So that's even worse than a face.
It was rubbish. I didn't even really... I just
You're not allowed to do it in boxing.
All right, Howard, what's he doing now with his life?
I imagine he's got a family and stuff. You know, he's probably all right. You know, he's fine.
Probably all right, if you can remember.
But my question was going to be...
Three of the kids.
My question is going to be, do you like... You obviously don't like being hit. Do you like hitting the other people, Travis?
Do you know what? In the boxing space, I'm going to say 100% yeah. Like, all the trainers I've trained with, they all kind of have said the same thing. It's like, yeah, you've got a bit of spite about you. Where it's like... If I've hit you and I know I've hurt you, I come alive. Like, it just feels like, okay, yeah. You know what I mean? Like, I don't know how to describe it.
I think anybody who knows.
Those who know that feeling.
You might be in Bury St. Edmunds now, but you're definitely from South East London, Travis. When I bang a man in his face and I see the pain in his eyes, that's me. That's my space there. That's when I know I'm going to be in his nightmares, and that makes me happy. When a man looks over for his family, that's when I love mine more.
Thing is, I had a fight, yeah, and I put it on YouTube. And the maddest thing is, the first round of this fight, like, I had a bit of success. And then he had a moment, right? He got me up against the ropes and he's throwing shots. And I'm slipping them. But then I tried to lean on the ropes and one of the middle ropes was loose. So I tried to kind of rest on it way too much and I just had to go down. So the referee counted it as a count. So I'm walking back to my corner and it's just like, right, it looks like I fully lost that round. Second round, I come out and I knock this guy out. And if you see the way I celebrate, bro, you think I was there by myself, no trainer, no family. Because my trainer comes to give me a hug and I'm like, nah, bro. I'm jumping on the corner.
Move!
I mean, I remember I remember a friend of mine.
The Conor McGregor of comedy, Travis J.
I had a friend of mine who had a group of friends from school, and then, you know, you meet some friends through that friend, right? All those friends. Yeah. And so this was a friend of a friend, but I spent a fair bit of time with the guy. Saw him in the street, you'd say hello, right? And anyway, I remember many years ago now, he decided to take up a boxing career, and he was apparently really good.
Okay.
And so, like, we went to that place that's near, is it Bethnal Green?
York Hall,
yeah, famous for boxing, right? Yeah, went for his first fight. We went to watch him. It's me and a guy called Alex, who's a friend of mine, a guy called Stu, like all these boys that I grew up with, right?
Yeah.
Chris, this guy Chris was there. It was a real, you know, it was a big old crew of people. And this guy, and I'm not going to name him because I don't want to, you know, make it in case. We were obviously cheering him on, and he goes into the ring and they stop the fight in 30 seconds.
Does he win?
The opposite. And I just remember, and it wasn't, I can't, to be honest with you, because it happened so quickly, I can't even really remember what happened, other than obviously it didn't go well.
Yeah.
That much I know. And it stuck with me to think there's such pride in what goes on in that world, mm-hmm. you know, and obviously you watch a fight on the street, I would not think the word pride is the first thing that comes to mind. I often think dickheads.
Yeah, exactly.
Travis just thinks these men are just doing haymakers all the time, bruv. Where is the guard, bruv? Where's the body shots? Man's solar plexus is wide open.
What's the game plan right
now?
Yeah,
what's the game plan? Who's a southpaw here? Who's orthodox? I can't tell anything. These are savages.
But the pride that there is in going into a ring, it must be intense as fuck. Like me and Dane occasionally talk about, I've played a lot of football in my life.
Yeah.
You get really into it, right? You get really into it, but you're not at the same level that you're talking about with
that's right.
boxing.
No, I mean, I've described it as like the most like adrenaline rush thing I've ever experienced. Like it's nothing like stand up. I don't care how big the crowd is. When you walk into the minute you get into the ring, for starters, it's way warmer than it is anywhere else in that whole space. And it's hard to describe, but the lights, the heat of the lights, something else. You get in there and it's just like, you do know you could die in here, right? And you sign that waiver form, right? It literally says, if you die here today, you know, not so many words, if you die today, we're not liable. So you sign that shit knowing that you believe that you're going to be all right. It is the most insane experience to now be fighting someone and like, I could die and nobody's going to have to like pay for this.
Travis, like, you know what you're saying is, and my mum's randomly just texted me to say, are you okay? And not knowing that we're talking about this now, but you know what?
And you wonder why you've never been punched in the face. It's got nothing to do with you, Howard. There is an angel of a woman. There is an angel of a woman who loves you, who would die first before she lets someone lay a hand on her baby. She heard it in the ether. Someone
was so well timed.
She heard so it in the ether. Somebody is troubling.
She was like, Howard is in danger.
Who the fuck is going near Howie Bear
with this violence?
It's incredible. What an incredible moment.
She's like, I named you after a cartoon duck. What's going on here, bruv? Need to relax. No, the psychology that comes with being with boxing and stuff like that as well. There's something very, very intimate about it there's something intimate about it whereby if you can be punched in the face, and I think there's just a rush of it. You know, when you talk about free will.
Mm.
I think your will is definitely tested if you're punched in the face.
100%.
Because then it's like your will to survive, your will to fight,
Your
will to carry on. So
to keep going, yeah.
Then you become aware of how strong your resolve obviously, after you punch someone in the face a lot of the time, they embrace afterwards.
That's what I was about to say.
Even when you're in school, like you have some beef with somebody and it's like, you have a fight and then after that, you're probably cool afterwards.
You walk on together.
Yeah.
But because there's a weird bond that happens with someone that you fight. I never thought I'd ever experience it. And like after the fights, you just want to hug them. It's such a weird thing because it's like, I get myself psyched up to a place where I'm like, I hate you. You're responsible for anything that's wrong in my life. And then afterwards, it's like a quick wave of like, bro, we've just put each other through our paces just now. And
gives me a different perspective on the film Fight Club.
Well, it's a thin line between love and hate. And I guess if hatred being that strong feeling you feel, There, like I said, there is no more extreme disposition you'll be in as a human being other than in a ring, fighting for your life.
That's right.
And so once you are met, and that's from the fear of losing, the fear of harm, isn't it? So you're, this is at the maximum of your ego. Mm-hmm. So if you think about your ego clashing with somebody else's, once you've had those two broken that, all that's left is the human, isn't it? So that's why it's like, I've faced the brink of this person's humanity and defenses, isn't it? Once we're both through it, what else is there left by humanity? That's probably why people feel the will to embrace, because it's I've experienced, I'm now going to give the balance to experiencing the other extreme of humanity, that fight for survival. And now it's like, it's nothing can make me more conscious of the fact that you are another human being, because I saw you display the same instinct and will to live. And so, that's where that intimacy comes from, I guess. So that could be a great way of... Nothing makes you feel more human than getting boxed in the face, I guess.
Well, I've definitely learned something here today, Dane, about that. So that's educational for me.
Keep your hands up, Howard, as well.
Keep your hands up, Howard, and don't I don't recommend it.
It's interesting though, I would actually say, having a kid, I don't know if I've ever mentioned that I have a kid.
No, you haven't.
That fucking listener gets pissed off. one guy.
Howard, tell your mum. Tell your mum what this fool said, bro. Tell your mum what he said.
I feel protective over the kid, right? So that's kind of an interesting thing. But I don't know.
Just to piggyback on that, that I started boxing when I had my daughter. So there's definitely a link there.
Definitely. I've loved talking about that, and I'm gonna swing it over to Dane with a swing over to Dane for his question.
It was a good swing though, Howard. Yeah, nice. Cheers, swing there. Man. Good form. Good form. You got potential.
Thanks, mate.
So for Travis, I think you have a very nuanced experience as a comedian, which I don't think a lot of our peers have in this country, in that you have legacy and heritage.
Yeah.
In that, you know, I think unlike a lot of our contemporaries, you come from a creative family.
Yeah.
So you have people that know that, Travis's dad is a musician. His mother is a very successful comedian, writer, actress, playwright by the name of Angela Maher, who surprisingly hasn't been on this podcast yet, but appeared alongside myself and Travis in the documentary Black, British and Funny, which is produced by Mo Gilligan. So check that out if you haven't already. But the reason, my question is basically on the fact that, like, obviously, in retrospect, when I reflect on my career, like, even as when I was like 7, 8, 9, I knew I wanted to do comedy.
Mm.
What I didn't know was how you went about doing it. I think I liked being funny and I liked performing. When I was 15, I saw Leo Muhammad and Russell Peters and D.L. Hughley at the Catford Broadway Theatre. Then I heard Krzysztof Bick and Blacker, and that's when I was like, this is what I want to do. But again, I had no idea how to pursue that. And it was at that age, there were very little, if no, references on how to do that other than like Bill McCoy. And even then, I was like, well, they must be people that are alumni that have gone to all the best schools and stuff, and this is how they've fallen into this work. There was never a trajectory that I saw that was clear up until I started doing comedy and working out how that process was.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure, and I imagine that would be very different for you, because you saw that being worked out, and the idea of comedy being a viable career seemed like it was would have made much more sense to you. And I feel like one of the things I do with my work is try to provide that same legacy for future generations of comics and stuff as well.
Mm-hmm.
But my question was really just, I think it's rare that a lot of Black creatives in this country in particular have that legacy as well. So I wanted to find out for you, what was it like actually coming from a family of professional entertainers as a Black British person?
You know what's funny is my relationship to the Black circuit. It's one of the ones where I've always felt like it might be different to other comics on the same circuit, because for me, it feels almost like a family business. And I don't mean that in the fact that it's mine and I was handed the circuit and you guys are on my circuit. It's not that type of thing. But when my mum talks about the beginning, like her reference points, and I'm like, I've got names and places when she talks about how there was no circuit. It was the fact that they weren't given the same opportunities on the mainstream space. Uh-huh. So they decided that they were going to do shows somewhere else to their own kind of audience. And this started off like in nightclubs, interrupting raves and all those kind of things. And you hear the stories and you think to yourself, like, well, look at where we are now. We're attached to this journey. So that's kind of why I've always kind of drifted away from... You get some comics who, and you know, I'm not going to get into the names or any specific references, but almost like going mainstream feels like, you know, oh, now I'm doing it for real.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? As if the black circuit is literally like, you know, rubbish or what, that type of thing. Yeah, that feels like very personal when I hear that.
No, I feel you. I agree with it as well, man. I definitely agree with it.
Yeah. There's a lot of comics who developed all the skills that they have and they take into their career and go mainstream. You know, I'd say I'm somebody who I've gone mainstream to a degree. Do you know what I mean? Obviously not the higher heights, but those are the circuits that I operate on now, probably more so than the black circuit.
Sorry to cut you, So you know, we both know Darren Watson. So Darren Watson was one of the people I would say was very responsible for a large renaissance in good, like, black comedy shows. Definitely helped me when I first started out. So shout out Darren.
Big time.
One thing he said that I found was very interesting, because he spoke about the same phenomenon of, like, comedians feel that they are transferring to what they call the mainstream, which is more lucrative and actually constitutes to more validation and recognition. But he said, really, even amongst predominantly white rooms and white comics, there's only a select few of them who are regular mainstays on panel shows.
There's
only a few of them that are doing the arenas. So that's not even mainstream. You might be playing a predominantly white circuit and by the merit of living in a majority white country, but really and truly, like, even white comics will tell you that, like, the money doesn't necessarily mean it being that amazing, and it's not really the position whereby just doing this circuit means you'll be predisposed to success. So I definitely agree with you on that one, man. I definitely agree.
It's real.
Yeah.
It's real. And I think what was interesting is, like, starting stand-up, because I never looked at stand-up as something I wanted to do. But, you know, looking back, it was always around me. So, like, I'd seen Bill Bellamy live probably about 12 years old. I'd seen pure shows of my mum's because, you know, when it's the theatre and it's you just can be backstage, there's nobody checking your age and all that kind of stuff. Do you know what I mean? And I just had access to comedy all the time. So, like, growing up, I wanted to be in the NBA. I wanted to play basketball. But I'd watch comedy to relax myself, to prepare for matches. So when I look back, comedy was always this fixture in my world. It was only when I gave up on the dream at 21 years old and I was just like, right, if I was going to make it to the league, somebody would have known me by now or, like, contacted me to...
I mean, Travis, that's not very Ian Wright of you. You know that he's going to get discovered until 25, but...
I hear that, bro, but...
It's worked out either way. Yeah, I feel you.
I was like, I'm not even the best player on my team. Like, I need to figure something out.
there's a B, a plan B is all. That's all right. That's healthy. I mean,
they're going to take all these dudes before me. So I was like, I started going out more because, like, how I played basketball was just like military, like every day, 6 a.m., boom, after work, boom, training. So I went to a comedy club and I looked at, like, it was Kojo's Funhouse. And I remember just thinking, oh my days. But that feeling of, like, oh, I can do that. It was real. But when I brought it to my mum, her response was very much like, if you're going to pick up this legacy, you best respect it. Her words were actually, don't embarrass me.
So, I mean, that was my parents' words as well. So straight.
So the pressure, like, obviously the whispers of, oh, it's Angela, my son, that was on my back quite heavy. And I knew from early I was never going to be able to escape this legacy that's on my name, even though I don't go by her name.
Yeah, yeah.
It was just one of those things. I thought, you know what, let me respect the legacy and work hard and dedicate myself. And it's, I think, because of that responsibility I almost feel, it makes me go hard all the time. Do you know what I mean? So it's
absolutely.
When you look at the relationship or the legacy and all that stuff, I'm like, I can't disrespect the pioneers by not going hard. When I was in the changing rooms with Felix Dexter and Curtis Walker and all this, my mum would go on stage and be like, you lot watch Travis. So, like, that's my experience of the first wave. Leo Muhammad, these men, when I see these guys, they're like, oh, look how tall you are. Look how tall you're getting now. You look like your dad. Those are the conversations I'm having when I see these guys around. So it's very much like, I can't come out here and embarrass the circuit, can't embarrass the legacy. So it's pressure that I'm used to now, but it was very heavy in the beginning.
Well, I think anyone that's seen Travis live, and if you haven't, I recommend it. I saw him at Edinburgh doing his show, which he and Dane may talk about Edinburgh in a different way again, as we often do on this show. But you're a very natural presence up there, as in it doesn't feel that you're watching, you know what I mean by that. You know, sometimes you're watching people and you feel they're reading a script. You never felt that way watching you, mate. But the kind of that pressure is fascinating. And the black circuit, which we've talked about, God, how many times on this show, Dane? Many times. I think that must invite its own pressure.
Big time.
Yeah, I was going to say, I would say now, for people that are aware, that what I would say is a key part of what makes social media relevant and current is largely fueled by the black circuit, or I'd say jokes and sensibilities and aesthetics of the black circuit. Like, it's the black circuit which has allowed for somebody like Mo to reach these well-deserved heights of success. Mm. And that black circuit is the same one that, before anyone knew Man's Not Hot, were the people that were booking Michael Dapper to perform live stand-up as well. So, you know, I mean, you know, Travis can verify this as well. Like, obviously now people are aware that, you know, Dave Chappelle, that's the hottest ticket, comedy ticket in town.
Yeah.
But we remember 2007 when no one in this country knew who he was, and he'd go to a Cork's Wine Bar in Binney Street because the Black Circuit recognised these people from across the pond very early on in their careers. So
I once did a gig on a Black Circuit, Dane. I don't know if I've ever told you that before.
Which one?
It was in Leighton. A restaurant on a Sunday afternoon. I did that comedy for like 2 years, Travis, just to prove that I could.
Yeah.
When I got booked for the gig, I was booked for even £20, which I was quite excited about. And then I turned up, and I'd be lying if I said, as a kind of white Jewish man, that I didn't feel slightly worried about this, you know, purely black audience, mainly of people who look like they've recently gone to church. They were dressed very smart. And I'm not smart in the way I dress. And I'm mainly there to talk about my sexual inadequacies, like many Jewish comedians. And I think about three jokes in, when I started to approach my my stuff about my lack of a foreskin, it was not an experience I was hoping to be. I never wanted to relive that again.
You was in front of church aunties talking about foreskin. Oh my word.
But I tried to, you know what I did? You know what I did? I did actually adapt a little bit as I was going along by saying, everything that I'm going to say, I clearly know that you don't want me to say anymore. Which did help a little bit.
Yeah, of course. Yeah. It's a learning curve, man. And I think it's interesting about people talking about the experience on the Black Circuit. I really think it's just down to, it's down to experience. If you have a large contingent of mainstream media, that doesn't really show you the range and the broadness of, you know, the black social or ideological disposition. People find it very hard to relate because if you, you know, because I would have similar problems myself, not so much like maybe subject matter, but maybe terms of delivery. And I've learned from experience now that you take a look at a black audience now and, you know, give them that grace of being like, part of it is kind of like knowing, I still say the same thing, but it's the way to say it and just to build the context first.
Yeah.
But even then, Howard, I say experience now, the last thing I did, Travis was at when I did Kojo's Funhouse, it's like, that was like a representation of the fact that like, I understand this crowd a lot more now and I understand the position I have to take with them in order for them to understand what I'm doing.
Did you start on the mainstream and go with Black Circuit or the YouTube?
No, my first show was actually Funhouse, Kojo's Funhouse.
Oh, okay, right, okay.
And then I kind of... But I didn't really do a lot of gigs because I just didn't really know how to pursue gigs. What do you do to like,
you know,
get kind of gigs? So I think my second gig was the one we did. Remember that time in Luton?
Oh!
What's so bad about Luton? What's so bad about Luton?
Oh, that show was crazy.
I quit comedy for a couple of years, remember?
What were you saying on the train home?
Yeah,
so I think I might leave this for a while, you know?
Yeah, because I just wanted to learn about what I was doing, how to do it, and why I was doing it. And Howard, Travis and I... Travis was threatened before we went on stage. I remember because there was a woman that went on before. And so Howard, based on the experience you said as well, is because, you know, in many ways, black audiences have not been given the privilege of having comedians that reflect their experience anyway. So it's taken a while for them to, for their palates to get used to the very different types of comedy. In the same way that you could argue that white audiences' ears now are a lot more attuned to musical black origin in this country more than they were like, you know, when I was at university, for example. They've had more exposure to it through the democratization of the internet and stuff. So, like, me and Travis did this gig in Luton. I remember it I don't remember the weather, but I think I'm going to say grey.
It was like performing at somebody's...
There was an EDL march, remember? The football match as well.
The road,
there was an EDL march as well, so you knew it was going to go well.
Yeah, as soon as you step out the train station, it was very hostile.
It was palpable in the air, man.
Yeah. But then I remember like getting to the show and thinking to myself, this doesn't feel like a normal black gig. This feels very much like we're performing at someone's, it's just like a youth club, like a gathering
like a youth
of
club
everybody's friends.
A youth club on a Tuesday.
Yeah.
Not a weekend, not bank holiday youth club or summer holidays youth club. It's Tuesday.
Oh, man. Guy asked me halfway through one of my jokes, like I'm a storyteller, so it's like I was in this story and the joke wasn't landing, and he just went to me halfway through, he's like, where are you from, bruv?
Yeah, I remember that.
I remember thinking, oh snap. So I just said, oh, Oxford Street, Central London, and he's like, yeah, that's not funny still. I was like,
oh no,
I'm ready to go home.
We were out there quickly. we left quickly after that, and no, but like I said, I remember, boy, that was a tough one. Because which brings me to the point, I was saying Travis as well, because you know, you said you've heard whispers of people being like Angela Marsan, et cetera, et cetera. Yeah. It's a strange phenomenon because obviously a big part of the narrative
in the drive for inclusion is that we have opportunities. But, you know, the entertainment industry, like any other industry, is largely fueled by nepotism, and it's not always what you know, it's who you know. Now, this works beneficially for a lot of people that we see. Rarely as black people do we even have the opportunity to enjoy nepotism. Like, so, you know, is it something, not that you've necessarily gained advantages from it, but do you think it's something that should be a lot more encouraged? And it's,
you know what's interesting,
what do you think it's obviously been beneficial for you?
Because I don't necessarily, it's funny, because I don't feel like I've gained, actually what I've gained from the relationship with my mom is having someone who knows stand-up. Yeah. And because she directs and she writes and she's quite, like, she's very much moved to the behind the scenes of entertainment now. Mm-hmm. So when she directs, her directing skills are like elite, almost up there with her stand-up. Mm-hmm. So I had that back in me to the point where, you know, I'd write material and stuff like that. A lot of people probably imagine that we write together, but we never really wrote together. It's more like I'd present a joke and then she'd be like, tell you where you could go. Maybe you could try this. And it was just that kind of, it was just that.
Actually, comics work together. Yeah, like two, that
but,
can experience.
But this didn't get going until maybe 3 or 4 years into stand-up. Mm. She was very much like, you have to experience everything yourself because I can't get up there for you. You're going to have to be a comic that gets up there, gets those skills of being able to improv when stuff goes left or things change. You got to earn those skills that cannot be taught to you in this house. Mm. Do you know what I mean? So she was very standoffish. So I feel like the gains came very much with my craft more so than the opportunities because, you know, my mom being big when she was and, you know, the type of success she had, she's very much an icon in the black community. Mm-hmm. Do you know what I mean? There's no black gig or whatever. Or
oh, most, facts.
You know what I mean? I could stop most black women today and be like, do you know Angie Lamar? And they're, yeah. But as far as mainstream reach and success, it didn't really, it wasn't there for me to be like, yeah, I can walk into the BBC and they're going to be like, come in, crack on. It wasn't that type of benefit. But, you know, when it came to my craft and the pressure I had from my parents to deliver a level of stand-up, and my dad was very instrumental in it as well because he was her voice to come off stage. How was that? Yeah, this happened, da-da-da-da-da. So both of their contributions very heavy. So that pressure of delivering quality stand-up was where I felt like their involvement.
Amazing to get that insight, I think, because it, as you say, Dane, makes Travis quite a unique presence in our world, hey? And what a brilliant episode, mate. What a brilliant mixed bag of questions in this show. It never ceases to amaze me when we do it.
Punch after punchline, punch after punchline. That was it. That was it. Uppercutting satire and all that stuff.
There you go, mate. There you go.
Nah, man. It's obviously always good to hear from you, Trav.
No, likewise, bro. Likewise, well. Man.
So, obviously, I know your stuff. I know the jokes. Those who are listening, particularly the finance versus greeting cards ones, look out for that and many other jokes that Travis has. So, for our audiences, Travis, where can they find out more about your good work?
Hey, follow me on my socials, Twitter and Instagram, Travis, J-E-N-T. So, that's Travis, J-A-Y-E-N-T. And, that's where I'm posting all my stuff and everything that's going on.
Nice. Cool. Also, podcast.
The Undefeated Podcast. Follow that on Instagram, The Undefeated Podcast. And we've just been like working with The Zone like recently.
Nice.
That was a great experience. Yeah. We was at fight camp. And I'm telling you, man, you talk about these fighters, but when you see them in real life, bloody hell, bro. It's scary.
Oh, I've met David Hay. I have the body of a child.
Bro, listen. Derek Chisora?
I met him.
Most intimidating man I've met in my life.
He's so intimidating. I went to the gym, listened to me, he went, yo, I got a joke for you. I was like, I'm all ears. I am all ears, Mr. Chisora. What do you got, buddy? How should I deliver that?
This is how he walked up to us, yeah? We're standing by the bus behind these little railings. This guy grabs a railing with one hand, moves it, beeline straight towards us. As he's coming towards me, I'm thinking to myself, wait, what have I said about Chisora? Because I'm thinking, has he clocked our faces? He comes over, shakes our hand individually, stops, he opens the railing from the other side, takes a half step out, then he looks back at us and just goes, recognize a real lion when you see one. Closed the barrier and walked off. I had no idea how to process that.
Okay, sir.
I was like, yeah, I see it.
Yes, sir, I see it because this... This is the thing about Derek Chisora, yeah, is that if you don't run enough in time, you can start running, but you won't be out of the width of his body.
That's right.
So you can start running, but you won't be out of his chest span. I'll show you a picture of me next to Derek Chisora. Yeah.
I've seen it. I remember.
Yeah, you've seen it. I'm a child next to this guy.
It's a door. He's literally as wide as a door frame.
I've seen, but I'd say more like a lift door, because two people can just hit him at the same time. He is a he's a wardrobe door at least.
It's insane.
Well,
it's insane.
Travis, you've been a great guest, mate.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you very much. Oh, and also, listeners, check out Travis J on Drunken Histories alongside Ratman and KG the Comedian on Comedy Central UK on their YouTube channel as well. Lots of good stuff. But yeah, Travis, it's been a pleasure, brother. Good to see you, and thank you very much for coming on.
Thanks for having me, guys. Thanks for having me.
You've been listening to Dane Baptiste Questions Everything, hosted by Dane Baptiste. For more from Dane, go to danebaptiste.co.uk or follow him on Twitter at DaneBapTweets or Instagram at DaneSnapTeast. Our guest was Travis J. You can follow Travis on Twitter and Instagram at TravisJEnt. The show is produced by me, Howard Cohen. Follow me on Twitter and Instagram at TheHowardCohen. The show is mixed and mastered by Audio Culture. You can follow Audio Culture on Instagram at WeAreAudioCulture. Please rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to us. You can find us on Twitter and Instagram at DBQEPodcast. Thanks to Polly, Gelly and the Acast team for all their support. Thanks for listening, guys. And remember, question everything.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.